The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
In its best form, a library shouldn't just be a repository of knowledge, but should also be a pillar of the community. And if this vision is to be the pillar of this city that I love so much and call home, then I think we all have a very good reason to be proud. So, thank you. Good evening, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Scott Edward Reed, and I'm a board member of the Raven Society. This is the Free Library's membership group for literary enthusiasts in their 20s and 30s. Dedicated to supporting the library's mission by contributing supplemental resources to existing programs and by hosting additional educational, social, and fundraising activities, the Raven Society is a fun way to get involved with the library while contributing to the welfare of our community. Detailed information on the Raven Society, including exclusive membership benefits, is available in the outside lobby. Now, before I introduce our special guest, please, please, please take a moment to silence your cell phones. I'd also like to remind you that there will be a book signing immediately following this event in the lobby upstairs. In I, Too, Sing America, Langston Hughes had the temerity to proclaim that the Black American experience is, in fact, the American experience. It is an integral part of this grand multicultural experiment. Louise Erdrich takes this vision and expands it as wide as the North Dakota sky of her mother's native Chippewa people. Her earlier works, Jack Light, a collection of poetry, and the 1984 National Book Critics Circle Award-winning novel, Love Medicine, introduced us to characters with voices so soulful and so full of history that they invoked in all readers a sense of familiarity and a profound connection to them. Now, 25 years, 12 novels, plus numerous other publications of children's books and nonfiction later, and in his spare time, having time to open up a Birkbeck Books in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is something you can reach by birkbeckbooks.com, Louise Erdrich has made this truth self-evident to every reader, that no matter which tribe we claim as our own, there are certain universal elements to humanity. We love, we suffer, we survive. Our children carry on. I am eagerly anticipating returning to her familiar North Dakota landscape in her latest novel, A Plague of Doves. And it is my pleasure and great, great honor to introduce one of my literary heroes, Louise Erdrich.
Well, how good of you to come here tonight, and thank you. I was fortunate enough to spend just a few minutes speaking with Scott before, and it was a wonderful introduction. I'm so glad to be here. You know, I have never been here with book in hand. I came here just to enjoy the city. And since then, you have invented this amazing thing called the duck something. I'm disappointed that my kids weren't here, you know, to take this duck thing. I it was so unexpected, you know. I was so surprised. It's a beautiful city, and you don't have snow. That's one big thing that I noticed immediately. You have leaves, you don't have snow. When I left, it had just finished snowing a bit. And so Minneapolis is still caught in the throes of winter. But the piece I'm going to read tonight is from this book, The Plague of Doves. And the book has been with me for 20 years, you know, and this piece I'm going to read is one of the very, very first pieces that I ever wrote. The book really centered finally on an incident that was very hard for me to come to terms with. There was in 1897, although in this book I said it at a different time, a lynching in North Dakota that was the victims of that lynching were Native Americans. And few people know about that. And it was something that I just stumbled across. And one of the victims of that lynching was only 13 years old. And his name I commemorate in this book. His name was Paul Holytrack. I tried to find relatives or someone to tell me more, but I never could find anything or anyone who could tell me much. So the book is not about that incident, although it occurs in the beginning, so much as it is about the unsolved ramifications, the ramifications through generations of an unsolved crime. It's a mystery, and I never thought I'd write a mystery, but here it is. It's who really committed the murders that these American Indian men were hanged for. Who really did it? And you don't find out really until the last page. And the person who survives really doesn't even find out till the last page who the perpetrator was. But along the way, we see all the different ways that these the questions that hang in people's minds in a small society affect them. And the piece I'm going to read tonight, which is a piece that is called Satan, Hijacker of a Planet, is about a young girl who comes to meet a Bible salesman. And this Bible salesman is the descendant of one of the men who was hung. And whether he thirsts for this certain kind of power or whether it has come to him all on his own, it's never really answered even in my mind. But she, this girl, is dragged emotionally into his world. She's just a farm girl. Her name is Marn. And as we begin this, she's just sitting and waiting to help her mom when he drives in the yard. His name is Billy Peace, and he's going to found his own religion, and he's going to find so many people who are going to become adherents of his religion. And she's slowly going to fall away. Afterwards, we can have some dialogue back and forth and talk about it a bit more. I've never read this before, so I'm hoping it's going to work out. Satan, Hijacker of a Planet. A small town is called Pluto. It's right on the outskirts of the reservation. Billy Peace is a native man, a mixed-blood man, and Marn is of, you know, farm stock. You know, she's a solid young girl. On the outskirts of Pluto, on an afternoon when rain was promised, we sat on the deck and watched the sky pitch over reservation land. It was a drought-dry summer, and in the suspension of rain, everything seemed to flex. I could almost feel the timbers shake under my feet as the great searching taproots of the trees trembled. Still, the rain held off. I left my mother sitting in her chair, and I went to the old field by the house up a low rise. There, the storm seemed even likelier. Grasshoppers sprang from each step, tripped off my arms, legs, eyebrows. There was a small pile of stones halfway up the hill. Someone had cleared that hillside once to make an orchard, and that had fallen into ruin, and now there was only twisted silver branches and split trunks. I sat there and continued to watch the sky as out of nowhere, great solid-looking clouds built hot stacks and cotton cones. I was 16 years old. I was watching the wash of ink rain on the horizon when his white car pulled into our yard. A tall man, thin and tense, but with a shy and open smile. His eyes were brown and melting, rich as sweet milk caramel. I would find out later that they could freeze black or turn any color under the sun. He was dressed very neatly, wearing a tie and a shirt that was not sweat through, still ironed crisp. I noticed this as I was walking back down to the yard. I was starting to notice these things about men, the way their hips moved when they hauled feed, checked fence lines, the way their forearms looked so tanned and hard when they rolled up their white sleeves. I was looking at men, not with intentions, because I didn't know what I would have done if I got one yet, but with a studious mind. I was looking at them just to figure for pure survival. I never tried out my information, though, until Billy Peace arrived. He looked at me where I stood in the shade of my mother's butterfly bush. I'm not saying I flirted right off. I still didn't know how to. I walked into the sunlight and I stared him in the eye. "What are you selling?" I smiled and told him that my mother would probably buy it, since she bought all sorts of things, a pruning saw you could use from the ground, a cherry pitter, a mechanical apple peeler that also removed the seeds and cores, a sewing machine that remembered all the stitches it had sewed. He smiled back at me and walked with me to the steps of the house. "You're a bright young lady," he said, though he was young himself. "Stand close. You'll see what I'm selling by looking into the middle of my eyes." He pointed his finger between his eyebrows. I didn't see a thing. My mother came around the corner holding a glass of iced tea in her hand, and while they were talking, I didn't look at Billy Peace. I felt challenged, like I was supposed to make sense out of what he did. But at 16, I didn't have perspective on the things men did. I watched him from behind my mother, and I discovered what he had to sell. "It's Bibles, isn't it?" I said. "No fair." He put his hand across his heart and grinned at the two of us. He had seen my eyes flicker to the gold cross at his lapel. "Something even better." "What?" my mother scoffed. "Spirit." My mother turned and walked away. She had no time for conversion attempts. I was only intermittently religious, but I suppose I felt that I had to make up for her rudeness, so I stayed a moment longer. I was wearing very short cut-off jeans and a little brown T-shirt, tight old clothes for dirty work. I was supposed to help my mother clean out her brooder house that afternoon, to set new straw and wash down the galvanized feeders, destroy the thick whorls of ground spider cobwebs and shine the windows with vinegar and newspapers. All this stuff was scattered behind me on the steps. As I said, I was never all that religious. "There is a meeting tonight," he said. "I'm going to tell you where." He always told in advance what he was going to say. That was the preaching habit in him. It made you wait and wonder in spite of yourself. "Where?" I said finally. He told me directions, where the tent was pitched, and spoke to me, looking full on with sweetness of intensity, eyes brown as burnt sugar. I realized I'd seen his picture before in my grandparents' bedroom. Billy's was the face of Jesus, leaning his head forward just a little to listen for an answer as he knocked on a rustic door. I decided I would go, without anyone else in my family, to the fairground field that evening just to study, just to see. He was not the first speaker. I didn't see him until the main speaker finished his work and said a prayer. He called Billy to the front with a little preface. Billy was newly saved, endowed with a message by the Lord, and could play several musical instruments. We were to listen to what the Lord would reveal to us through Billy's lips. He came on the stage. Now he wore a vest, a three-piece suit, a red silken shirt with a pointed collar. He started talking. I could tell you just about what he said, word for word, because after that night and long away into the next few years, sometimes four or five times in one day, I'd hear it over and over. You don't know preaching until you've heard Billy Pease. You don't know God loss, a barbed wire ripped from your grasp, until you've heard it from Billy Pease. You don't know how light and comforted you feel, how cherished. And I was too young to stand against it. The stars are the eyes of God, and they've been watching us from the beginning of the earth. Do you think there isn't an eye for each of us? Go on and count. Go on and look in the book and total up all the nouns and adverbs. Like if you did, somehow you'd grasp the meaning of what you held. You can't. The understanding is in you or it isn't. You can hide from the stars by daylight, but at night, under all of them, so many, you are pierced by the sight and by the vision. Get under the bed. Get under the sheet. I said to you, stand up, and if you fall, fall forward. I'm going to go out blazing. I'm going to go out like a light. I'm going to burn in glory. I said to you, stand up. And so there's one among them. You have heard loose light, Lucifer, the fallen angel. You have seen it with your own eyes, and you didn't know. He came upon you in the night and in his own disguises like the hijacker of a planet. He fell out of the air. He fell out of the dark leaves. He fell out of the fragrance of a woman's body. He fell out of you and entered you as though he'd reached down through the earth, reached his hand up and pulled you down, fell into you with a jerk, like a hangman's noose, like nobody, like the slave of the night, like you were coming home and all the lights were blazing and the ambulance sat out front in the driveway and you said, Lord, which one? And the Lord said, all of them. You too, follow, follow. I'm pointing you down in the sight of the stars and the Son of Man. The grace is on me. Stand up. I said, stand. Let yourself into the gate. Take it with you. In 4 years, the earth will shake in its teeth. Revelations, face of the beast. In all fairness, let us sit down and let us think. Then Billy Pease looked intently, quietly, evenly at each person in the crowd, and he quoted to them, proving things about the future that seemed complicated, like the way the Mideast had shaped up as such a trouble zone, how the Chinese armies were predicted in Tibet and had come true, and how they'll keep marching, moving until they reach the Fertile Crescent. Billy Pease told them about the number. He slammed his forehead with his open hand and left a red mark. There, he yelled. Got shot. There it will be scorched. He was talking about the number of the beast and said they would take it from your social security, your checkbooks, these things called credit cards. American Express, he cried to oblivion. They would take the numbers from your tax forms, your cell phones, your household insurance. That already through these numbers, you are under the control of last things, and you don't even know it. The Antichrist is among us. He's the plastic in our wallets. You want credit? Credit? Then you'll burn for it, and you will starve. You'll eat sticks. You'll eat black bits of paper, your bills, and all the while you'll be screaming from the dark place, why the hell didn't I just pay cash? Because the number of the beast is a fathomless number, and banking numbers are the bones and the guts of the Antichrist, who is Lucifer, who is pure brain, pure brain, going to get us to the moon, get us past the moon. The voice of lonely humanity out there in a space probe calling, anybody home, anybody home? Antichrist will answer. Antichrist is here all around us in the tunnels and the webs of radiance, in the great mind of the Antichrist, fusing in a pattern, in a destiny, waking up nerve by nerve. Serves us right. Serves us right, don't it? Not to be saved. It won't come easy, not by waving a magic wand. You've got to close your eyes and hold out those little plastic cards. Look at this. He held a scissors high, turned it to every side so the light gleamed off the blades. The sword of zero interest. Now I'm coming. I'm coming down the aisle. I'm coming with the sword that sets you free. Billy P. started a hymn going, and he walked down the rows of chairs, singing, and every person who held a credit card out, he embraced, and he plucked that card out of their fingers, and he cut it once, crosswise, dedicated to the Lord. He cut it again. He kept the song flowing, and he walked up and down the rows, cutting until the tough, trampled grass beneath the tent was littered with pieces of plastic. He came to me last of all and noticed me and smiled. You're too young to have established a line of credit. He said, but I'm glad to see you here. Then he stared at me, his eyes hardened to the black of winter ice, cold in the warmth of his tan skin. So chilling, I just melted. We wandered in the desert 3 years, and I bore 2 children in the daze and rush of Billy's traveling visions. His cognitions came on us like Mack trucks, bowling us from tent to tent and town to town. He would howl with the signal, then writhe at tremendous sights he saw, shout for a pen and paper, growl and puke and wrestle with the knowledge until he lay calm on the bathroom floor, spent, saying to me, now do you doubt? I never did. I had faith in Billy from that first night I heard him speak. I had faith and I cleaved to him utterly. But as the months and then the years went by, I missed my mother and my father. I missed their ordinary routine, their low drama, even the familiarity of their quarrels. I missed that I could read their danger. I knew a safe place to be around them. I needed to go home. My father has been working the place practically alone, so he's let most of the fields go fallow and sold off all the stock but 5 milkers. Our return renews his hopes, though. High in a tractor, my father goes to see what of the new hay is not yet burnt hollow, what may survive. Watching my mother's sharp elbows swing as she backs down the bean rows, hoeing, I think that maybe it's not so awful to consider the reality of staying here. Maybe I should get together with my parents and make some plans. But there is no need. Billy says it all. Every night back in Dad's office now, Billy helps him straighten out the mess. He helps file, helps decide which bills to pay on and which to string along. Dad has agreed with surprising disinterest to let all Billy's people come and camp near an old farmhouse where a hand pump well is still in operation. The end of our land bumps smack up against the reservation boundary. This was reservation, Billy says, and should be again. This was my family's land. Indian land will be again. He says it flat out with a lack of emotion that disturbs me. Something's there. Something's different underneath. As 1 month and another month goes by, my husband, between attending to the needs of his people, guest preaching for rain at revivals held all through the area, between learning how to run a tractor and use milking equipment and bale hay with my father, hardly sleeps. Billy seems to whirl from one thing to another, his energy blooming, enormous, unflagging. The food he eats, whole plates of spaghetti, pans of fresh rolls. There are nights he paces Dad's office late, writing sermons and signing checks, for Dad has given him the power of signature. Sometimes at dawn I stumble downstairs for coffee and he's sitting there grinning, still up from the day before. Billy grows as the heat withers everything. He drinks the well dry. That summer we borrow from the bank and sink another well. Flushed and enormous, he splits the bottom of his pants. I never had parents. He chokes up, embracing my mother as she lets out and re-sews the seams of his pants. I never knew what it was like to live in a family before. She smiles at his drama, her face melting in the heat like wax. My mother bakes a cake from scratch every day. Billy eats it. He earns money with his preaching, hires a lawyer to incorporate us all into a church so we needn't worry over taxes. Soon, my parents' farmhouse becomes a focus. Each night, the rest of the congregation comes over and we all pray together in the living room, crying and witnessing and begging forgiveness. And when pure, sitting in a circle all together, channeling spirit. My mother is loud and extraordinary. Who knew? My father more reserved, blinking at what she spills, the plenitude and triviality of her sins. I begin, because Billy is so large and overpowering, to sit near my father on those nights. It is as if my dad needs protection. I think that he's grown more frail, although maybe it's simply relative. He seems thinner because Billy has expanded to such a marvelous size, outweighing us all, splendid in his new white suits. Another month passes and Billy's chins double, so he wears a thick flesh collar now. We make love every night, but I'm embarrassed. He's so loud, so ecstatic. I'm tossed side to side on top of him, as if I'm riding a bull whale. I make him wear a sleeveless undershirt so I can hold on to the shoulder straps like handles. The bed creaks like the timbers of a boat going down in a gale. I'm afraid of getting pregnant again. I'm afraid of what's happening. The house, once so calm in its barbed brown atmosphere, once lonely and predictable, crawls with people now. They're continually praying with my mother and cleaning savagely with harsh chemicals. Everything smells of pine sol. The yard is gouged with the tire marks of cars. People break the branches off the butterfly bush to fan themselves when the spirit revs their temperature. And I don't know who I married anymore. It's like he's supernatural. He is horribly tireless, exhausting everyone so much we have to keep shifts now to keep up with him. I carry his socks, shirts, underwear, trousers out to the clothesline to hang. They are so large now they do not require clothespins. I drape them like sheets. Then I sit, worn out, where I'm hidden from his eye. He talks rain. He talks Armageddon. The farm is made over to me now and through me to Billy. He talks about the founding of the Chosen. We are the ones, he says, who will walk through fire. We are the Daniels. And he holds our son up before the eyes of the congregation, and the poor boy as small as a fish in his hands. Finally, it is the picnic table and the iron bench that brings me to the end of this part of our life and the bigger, uncontrollable force that Billy becomes. The table is set out in the bare backyard, and it is made of sheet metal, steel pipes, and a welded crossbar hammered into the ground. Dad made it for days it was too humid to eat indoors and for general celebrations, of which we never had one. The whole area is laid out where the view is nice so that Mother, fond of her pretty yard and flowers, could gaze past a row of wild orange daylilies after she worked in the garden. She could pause, rest her eyes on a bit of loveliness. There is even an iron lace bench for sitting on, maybe reading, though nobody ever opened a book there. So one humid afternoon, I'm sitting with my mother on the couch, and we are watching Billy talk beneath the green ash tree with a few of the others. The babies are sleeping on the floor on folded quilts with fans spilling air over them back and forth. Billy rarely drinks, and then nothing stronger than wine. He is drinking wine now, a homemade variety from elderberries made by a congregation member from a recipe passed down through her family. I suppose that the wine has got such a friendly history that Billy feels he can drink more than usual. And then it is hot. The jars of wine are set in an icy cooler on the metal picnic table. And from time to time, Billy lifts out a jar and drains it. This makes me thirsty. As he talks, the sweat pours off his brow. His dark hair is wetted black. His body is huge, mounded over the iron bench. He lifts his thick arms to wrestle with a thought, drags it out of the air, thumps it on top of his thigh. He is holding a rain prayer meeting, and as we sit in the heat of the afternoon with the fans going, watching the others pray in the blazing sun, we notice that the clouds are massing and building into fabulous castle-like and blazing shapes. These clouds are remarkable. Pink gold lit within. They're beautiful things. I point them out to my mother. Thunder clouds, she says, excited. Push my couch closer to the window. Well, I should be out praying with the group or cooking dinner up for them all or working in the garden in case those clouds do bring hail, but I do nothing other than place a chair next to my mother's couch. My father enters the room. He has come to point out the clouds. Outside, Billy continues, wringing his hands into big golden fists, sobbing with the power, drinking the wine in swigs, shouting. And now the wind rises, slapping the branches crazy. The clouds ride over the land, gathering and bunching, reflecting light. They are purple, a poisonous pink, a green as tender as the first buds of spring. The clouds cover the horizon, and within the mass, as the thing opens over us, we see the heart of the storm, the dark side of the anvil shot through with an electric tracery of light. A cold wind rises out of the ditches, smelling of sour mud and water and then fresh. Small droplets, soft and tentative, plop down, and thunder is a cart full of stones rumbling closer. It's still they keep praying, with their hands held up and their eyes tight shut. Beneath the whipping leaves, pelted and in danger, they huddle. Their voices are a windy murmur. His voice stands out among them, booming louder as the storm comes on. A burst of radiance. The flowers fly into the air and scatter in the yard. Another crack so loud we're right inside of the sound. Billy Peace, sitting on that iron bench like an oracle, is the locus of blue bolts that spark between the iron poles and run along the lantern wires into the trees. Billy, the conductor, with his arms raised, draws down the power. The sound of the next crack slams us back from the window, but we crawl forward again to see. A rope of golden fire snakes down and wraps Billy twice. He goes entirely black. A blue light pours from his chest. Then silence. A hushed suspension. Small pools of radiance hang in the air, wobble, and then disappear. A few drops fall, mixed with small bouncing marbles of hail. Then whiteness tumbles through the air. Ice balls smash down the mint and basil and lemon balm, so the scents rise with the barbecue smell of burnt skin. We say nothing. The babies sleep. And Billy Peace? He is a mound, black and tattered on all fours, a snuffling creature of darkness burnt blind. We watch as he rises, gathers himself up slowly, pushes down on his thighs with huge hands. Finally, he stands upright. I grab my mother's fingers, shocked, limp. Billy is alive, bigger than before, swollen with unearthly power. We step away from the window. He balls into the sky, shaking his head back and forth as the clouds open. Harsh silver curtains of water close across the scene. We turn away from the window. Mom, I say, we've got to stop him. No one's ever going to stop him, she says.
Well, I think we could have listened for at least another half hour. The way this works, I think you probably know. Raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. And if you would keep your question specific and limit to one, because I have a feeling there are going to be a lot of questions. Who would like to start us off? Right here in the second row.
I'd just like to know about Fleur Pillager, if you could tell us about Fleur. Are you Fleur? Are you related to Fleur? How do you feel about her?
The question is about Fleur Pillager. Fleur is a character in some of the earlier books. I'm not any of the characters, but I feel when I'm writing each one of them, I feel very connected to them, and she's perhaps the one I feel most connected to. It's as though she would come back. She would sort of come back and I'll have a dream and know that I'm supposed to write about her. And it's as though I have this sensation that she exists more fully, somehow is realized somewhere else, and that I'm just taking dictation sometimes when I write about her. So she's very important to me. Thank you.
Another question? I was wrong about the questions. 1, 2, 3, right here. Gentleman in the beige, please.
Thank you for coming, and I've appreciated your books for many years. The reading you gave is marvelous. But one of the things I really love about so many of your books is the range of characters and moods that you can create. I'm wondering, just as kind of a promo for this book, you might want to give us a clue as to what some of the other folks in the novel look like.
You know, I was thinking about that because this Billy is there's so many other people in the book, and in The Plague of Doves, I thought maybe I'd just read a paragraph or something to give you an idea of what the title actually means or what it's about, if that's all right. I'll just read the first page. Actually, this is in a way you could call it a murder mystery, And later on, perhaps at the very end, I'll read the prologue, which is called Solo. It sort of sets up the mystery and the strangeness of the rest of the book. But the doves, the Plague of Doves, is actually from an incident that I read about in an old newspaper. Doves came down, blanketing this part of North Dakota that I'm writing about, and eating everything in sight. And so I'm just going to read this first page because this is an act. It's true that there was a priest who got his congregation to come out and try and pray them away. In the year 1896, my great uncle, one of the first Catholic priests of Aboriginal blood, put the call out to his parishioners that they should gather wearing scapulars and holding missals, and from that place they would proceed to walk the fields and loudly pray away the doves. When the birds descended, both Indians and whites set up great bonfires and tried driving them into nets. The doves ate the wheat seedlings and the rye and started on the corn. They ate the sprouts of new flowers and the buds of apples and the tough leaves of oak trees and even last year's chaff. The doves were plump and delicious smoked, but you could wring the necks of hundreds or thousands and effect no visible diminishment of their number. The pole and mud houses of the mixed bloods and the bark huts of the blanket Indians were crushed beneath the weight of the birds. They were roasted, burnt, baked up in pies, stewed, salted down in barrels, or clubbed dead with sticks and left to rot. But the dead only fed the living, and each morning when the people woke, it was to the scraping and beating of wings, the murmurous susurration, the awful cooing babble, and the sight to those who still possessed intact windows of the curious and gentle faces of those creatures. This is narrated by a young woman, Evelina Harp, and as she tells this story, she's recounting what her grandfather, her mushum, that's the word for grandpa in Chippewa, has been telling her, and he tells her the story of the doves. He weaves story after story for her, how he escaped the doves by finding this beautiful young girl and going down into the Badlands, where they are rescued by a character in the book named Mustache Maud, who is also a true character out of North Dakota history. Mustache Maud was a rustler, and she often liked to rustle pigs. And she rescues them. And he tells about this, and he tells the darker story of the lynching. And the lynching follows. I'll read the very first part later on that sets up the whole book. But we'll have maybe another question or two first.
Shall we? On the aisle here, gentleman with his hand up. Please wait for the microphone, sir.
Well, also, thank you for Fleur. But could you say a few words about the origin of Agnes DeWitt, Father Damien?
Oh, Agnes. Well, I had Father Damien pegged for a long time as a priest, male priest. And then as I wrote, I suddenly realized that was not the case. That was not the case at all. I realized I had to write this priest as a woman who lived her life out, following her calling as a priest. And my mother is a devout Catholic, so I went and said, I just think I have to write it this way. Is it all right? And she said, oh, go for it. She was happy about it. So I wrote it. But I think I felt in the writing of that, I really had to live through so much of what, I mean, I had to try and live through. I couldn't actually do it. But so much of what it must have felt like to live in a pose all of your life. How fantastically hard that was for her. And what a sense of commitment she had to have in order to carry that off her whole life. And love. I mean, the base of that character is of enormous love. She's a very good priest. Thanks.
Back here on the left in the red. If you'd keep your hand up, ma'am. Thank you.
I, too, am really glad that you're here. Can you talk a little bit about... you tell so many of the legends of that are part of the Chippewa history, some of the you know, the things that take place in the lake and the things that happen to people. Can you talk a little bit about that? And does your mother or people from that tradition, have they read your books, and are they as enthralled, or do they feel that you've portrayed that, and do they enjoy it as much as we do, I guess?
Well, I really can't speak for every Chippewa person. No, I don't know. Some people love them. Some people might be offended by some parts, especially of the Catholicism. The reservation where my mother's from is very, very Catholic. And for a long time, my grandfather practiced both the traditional religion and Catholicism. And that was good with the priests. They were very accepting. And I think that's what, in the beginning, made them so well accepted by the people there. And they become a little more... the order has changed. They were Benedictines when my mother was growing up. And now they're they're more of a fundamentalist or charismatic Catholic sect as they're now, or it's very different. But people are still very Catholic and very devoted to St. Anne. That's the name of the... that's the name of the church. And there's processions every year on her name day, her day. And it's something that... So people aren't always happy about the way religion is portrayed. On the other hand, sometimes they're saying it doesn't go far enough because also people were hurt very badly. You know, it's a mixed... religion always has a mixture of effects on people. And it's never all good, it's never all bad.
In the turquoise over here.
I want to know, in Jack Light and the Antelope Life, or Antelope Wife, mm-hmm. Deer are transformational or transforming characters. Where does this idea originate from?
Well, that is from an old kind of a powwow story where some guy flirts with or snags a beautiful woman, and when he gets her home, he realizes she's got hooves. He knows that something's not quite right here. So I was always fascinated with that story. And then I'd come across that. It was a beautiful quote by Blackfoot woman, Pretty Shield, who said, "The antelope are strange people. They appear and disappear across the plains. They're very beautiful. Sometimes a man will follow the antelope and be lost forever." And I also, you know, I don't know exactly who it was, but I once read this quote by an elderly Native man who said, "No, I never kill deer. I never kill antelope. They're placed here because the Creator meant for us to have a form of beauty. They're a form of beauty. You know, they're a form of the Creator's art. So he never did. Other people, you know, they're nuisances because we don't have, the predator chain has gone awry. So we've got deer everywhere now. But they were once much more scarce."
A few more questions. Lady on the aisle here.
I wanted to ask about your nonfiction book, The Blue Jays Dance. And I have read that you have a number of children. I was wondering what made you write that book about that pregnancy as opposed to any of your other children's births, and what you wanted to say about motherhood, perhaps, or the process of giving birth, and if it had some connection to your writing.
It has every connection, you know. It has every connection, I think. I really had looked around for examples of women who had children and who continued to write literary fiction, and there were very few. One of my great examples was Kay Boyle, another Toni Morrison, who said very wonderfully that she felt that being a mother increased the depth of her work. And I felt it was very complicated. I felt that being a mother and the demands of a person's art sometimes coincide and sometimes don't. And still, I have four daughters, and I have a seven-year-old, so it's kind of hard to pry me out of my house, as I was telling Andy. I don't know that it's a conflict, but it's hard to see where the intersections are. So I wanted to write this book because sometimes, you know, when I was taking care of my babies, and I did that, but the Chippewa have a wonderful, very simple cradle. You don't even need a battery for it. It's a rope swing that is hung up, and you have the end of the swing. Other people may use this, and the blanket is very neatly put between the two ropes. There's sticks on either end to hold it open. The baby sleep, you just put the baby in there when the baby's kind of sleepy, and then just swing with your foot. So, you know, I was always riding like this, you know, and I had the baby swinging, and I was able to write with my babies with me for, and I, you know, I just felt that that was something that I wondered about. I thought, I don't know how this is affecting me, but I know that there isn't a male writer alive who's stopped writing to nurse a baby, you know. It's a different, and I'm going to write about it. So that's why I wrote The Blue Jays Dance.
Gentleman right in front here.
It would seem to me, just listening to your short story, that you see nature as a force that is actually subjugated to religious power, because this man, this minister in there, Billy Peace, actually becomes stronger and survives even thunder and lightning. So I wonder if you see, is there a balance between nature and religion, or how do you see the two forces?
Well, nature wins in the end. I mean, this is a temporary, you know, and I think that's true of us as humans. I mean, no matter what we do, the earth wins in the end. The earth doesn't really care, you know, we're here or not. And I wouldn't really generalize about the rest of my view of nature from that scene, because I really believe, like, this, there was a wonderful book called The World Without Us by Alan Wiseman. I don't know if anybody here has read The World Without Us. But it is a very simple premise, and that is suddenly everyone disappears. Say everybody's raptured away, you know, goodbye, humanity. We don't know how you left. But what happens to the rest of the world? You know, without us, the world is fine. Doesn't. And he was, as he went through this thought experiment, this wonderful thought experiment, like how everything would, what would stay, what would go. He went through what animals would survive, which would, you know, disappear, how fast your house would fall into ruin. And I love this book because it was how I felt about nature, which is that we're only here by some sort of strange permission, and I don't know what it is or if I'll ever find out. But I think Billy only has a limited time to experience that amazing power that he's got, just as we all do. Thanks.
And the lady in the blue right here.
There are three of us here, and we're all of German background, and of course I'm very interested about the Master Butcher Singing Club and how you bring these two very different worlds together of the, you know, German butcher and the Native Americans. And it was just fascinating for us because I personally had never read anything like that. You know, bringing those two worlds together.
Well, that's really my background. You know, my mother's French Ojibwe, and I belong to the Turtle Mountain Chippewa band of Chippewa. And then my father's German American, but his father only came over in the 20s, right after the end of World War I. So that I was around German speaking people a great deal growing up, and North Dakota has the highest percentage of German-speaking people when I was growing up, and so that I heard it all the time. And my grandfather was trained as Metzgermeister. He was trained in that old way, so that I have it's a very odd memory of both eating wild game, of course, and the sort of food that Native Americans, Chippewas eat, and also these fantastic old world sausages. you knew every kind of sausage. And after the Master Butcher Singing Club came out and was published, I heard from many people who had gone to his butcher shop, and they remembered going where he'd keep his kettle full of fresh boiled wieners, and he'd give them each a fresh wiener instead of a treat, and different things like this, you know. And the butcher shop is still standing, still there. It's fallen into ruin, but it really does have this little sign underneath that my mother painted with a big cow, and then underneath it says, "Our only dissatisfied customer." So I had this very rich background on both sides. I was very fortunate. And my grandfather died when I was pretty young, but my grandmother took over and ran that shop, and he passed on a lot of his knowledge to my uncles. So they all worked there.
Louise, why don't you close out the evening with the prologue you had intended to read?
Oh, okay. Maybe after this woman, there's one. She has one more question.
Okay, one more question. The lady right here in the middle, we could get her a microphone.
I have a loud voice.
Okay.
Ma'am, please use the mic. Thanks.
I have a sense that you see the world as kind of magical in a way, and that it enters into your writing, and that then maybe does your writing dialogue back and you see the world different yet again?
All right. I'm really confused by that question.
Sometimes you see the world kind of as a magical place,
yeah,
the force,
yeah,
of nature and the things that happen. But then as you're writing, does it transform the way you began to look at the world and see?
Oh, I see. What
is there a kind
question
of a dialogue between yourself and yourself, kind of?
That's an interesting question. I guess that's why I didn't get it. I would think, you know, I think so. I feel that I always felt as a child that I saw things a little differently. I was pretty much the lonely kid. And I think that's where it started, that I did have not your ordinary sense of what was happening. I was a very challenging child, but I never challenged my parents. I challenged the spiritual world all the time. I remember, like Billy, I suddenly realized in second grade, if I wonder what will happen if I say I don't believe in you, God. And I stood in the middle of this sidewalk on the way to school, and I said it, and then nothing happened. And I'd expected to die. I just wanted to see. But, you know, and I walked on. So, anyway, All right. Now, this little piece I'm going to read, it's kind of... a couple of reviews have called it creepy, so... I really apologize because I think it is a little scary, but it also is, it's what really informs the rest of the book. And I want to read it because by the end of the book, you know the mystery and it's solved what is happening in this scene. It's called Solo. The gun jammed on the last shot. And the baby stood, holding the crib rail, eyes wild, bawling. The man sat down in an upholstered chair and began taking his gun apart to see why it wouldn't fire. The baby's crying set him on edge. He put down the gun and looked around for a hammer, but saw the gramophone. He walked over to it. There was already a record on the spindle, so he cranked the mechanism and set down the needle. He sat back down in the chair and picked up his work as the music flowed into the room. The baby quieted. An unearthly violin solo in the middle of the record made the man stop, the pieces of the gun in his hands. He got up when the music was finished and cranked the gramophone and put the recording back on. This happened 3 times. The baby fell asleep. The man repaired the gun so the bullet slid nicely into its chamber. He tried it several times, then rose and stood over the crib. The violin reached a crescendo of strange sweetness. He raised the gun. The odor of raw blood was all around him in the closed room. No, I'm going to just do one more thing that's funny. Okay, I can't just close that. That's just too creepy. All right. So Mushim, an old man, is dreadfully in love with Neve Harp, who's the sister of this man. And so he's always asking for information about this. They're both, she's elderly, but she's absolutely gorgeously fixy. And Mushim, the grandpa, really is prodding her brother, Evelina's father, for information. Is your sister fond of flowers? What's her favorite? Stinging nettles. Would you say she favors a certain color? Fish belly white? What were her charming habits when she was young? She could fart the national anthem. The whole thing? Yes. Oh, wow. How did she always have such pretty hair? She dyes it. How did she come to have so many husbands? Obscene talents. What does she think? What is her mind like? Our dad would just laugh wearily. Mind? He'd say. Thoughts? She's got her teeth, doesn't she? All of them? Except the ones she left in her husband's. I wonder if she'd be interested in memories of my horse racing days here on the reservation. Those could be considered historical. You only quit 2 years ago. Oh, but they go way back. He's really in love. So thank you. Thank you so much. All right.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.